kids. And Marty, we know you did it because we have your hair in your mother's hands. I'm thinking, wait a minute. I know I didn't do anything, but my father said that I did it. And they're saying my hair's in my mother's hands. I mean, I was a kid back then. And you start to doubt yourself. In the back of your head, you start to play tricks with yourself. You know, you start to doubt reality and you start to believe what they're telling you because they're confident. You know, the one thing I've learned is that their confidence makes you start to believe them.
Feeling lost?
Then you're in the right place.
I'm Amanda Knox.
And I'm Christopher Robinson.
And this
is False Confessions,
a Labyrinth miniseries.
...1988, Long Island, New York. Marty Tankleff was 17 when he awoke on the first day of his senior year of high school to find his mother in a pool of blood on her bed and his father in his study, unconscious, bloody and gurgling for air. He called 911 and hours later found himself sitting in a police interrogation room, confused, traumatized, and, shockingly, accused of killing his own parents.
Marty eventually confessed, and his confession, like mine, was internalized. That is, he came to believe, if only briefly, what the investigators were telling him. This is the more rare and hardest to understand form of false confession. In fact, there was no name for it when Professor Saul Kassin began researching this phenomenon.
I had just graduated from graduate school in Connecticut, went off to the University of Kansas to get involved in psychology and law research when I first got interested in confessions. And I came across a book about the Peter Riley case. Riley was accused of killing his mother in Connecticut, about an hour from where I went to graduate school. He's about my age. Peter found his mother dead and was interrogated for hours and hours. And then finally was offered an opportunity to take a polygraph test, which he agreed to because as innocent people do, they don't fear the test. In fact, they think this'll do it. We'll see, I didn't do this. His interrogation was recorded and there's a transcript after he's told Peter, I don't know how to tell you this, but the polygraph shows deception. You're lying. And sometimes the polygraph tells us things about a person that even they don't know. And it tells us you're lying. And he insists, not only didn't I do it, I wouldn't do it. Well, moments later, I don't know in temporal time because I just know pages later in this transcript, he says, your machine is starting to give me doubts. And then moments later, is it possible I did this? Could I have done this? I don't remember doing this. Oh, Peter, people often black out things they don't want to remember. And then finally, he caves in a kind of a crushed way and says, oh my God, I killed my mother. And proceeds to incorporate a narrative consistent with the narrative they had provided for him. I don't know how long that internalization state lasted. Sometimes it's momentary, and as soon as the pressure of the situation lifts, the person comes to their senses and goes, oh, wait a second, I didn't do this. And then sometimes, as in a case in Nebraska, even at the point of exoneration, and the person is really, oh my God, you mean I didn't do this? So internalization can last for a good long time. Or it can just be momentary. In Peter's case, you can see the breakdown from your machine's giving me doubts to, is it possible? They insert the blackout hypothesis and he kind of crashes to his head and goes, oh my God, looks like I killed my mother. And the confession is always in that it's not in the language of memory. It's in the language of inference. I must have killed my mother. Maybe I killed my mother. You know, no judge or jury is going to dissect the language here because who's going to make any kind of confession like that?
In fact, if you look at the statements Amanda was coerced into signing, you see this same language of inference. Here's Amanda reading the recantation she wrote immediately after her interrogation, when she was still slowly emerging from the trauma and disorientation. Pay attention to her if-then statements and use of the conditional tense, referring to events that could be true.
It was under this pressure and after many hours of confusion that my mind came up with these answers. But I've said this many times so as to make myself clear. These things seem unreal to me, like a dream. The police have told me that they have hard evidence that proves I was in my house at the time of Meredith's murder. I don't know what this proof is, but if it's true, then it means I am very confused and my dreams must be true. There's one thing that I think in myself is true, but there's another possibility that could be true, and I can't honestly think for sure what is what.
Nobody had identified these before as internalized false confessions, but there was clearly something there. And now, in light of everything we know about the effects of misinformation on memory, now I get it. Now I get what's happening. And under stress, people are particularly suggestible. There's a huge research literature now on false memories, on how misinformation can implant false memories. That literature didn't exist in the 1970s. There wasn't the psychology I could turn to.
That's because it was just getting off the ground with the work of Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, who would go on to become a world-renowned expert on the implantation of false memories.
So I study memory, and I study a particular aspect of memory, which is when people remember things that didn't happen, or they remember details that are different from the way they really were, or they remember entire events that never happened. So I study false memories.
How do you study false memories?
Over the last many decades, I've developed a couple of paradigms for studying memory. One of them is called the misinformation paradigm. And what happens here is people might see a simulated crime or an accident, and then we feed them some misinformation about what they saw. They may have seen a car go through a yield sign, and we suggest it was a stop sign. Or they may have seen a thief wearing a green jacket, and we suggest it was a brown jacket. Afterwards, when we come back to our research witnesses and say, we want to know exactly what you remember seeing, in many cases, they succumb to the suggestion and tell us that they saw something that was merely suggested to them by us. They saw the stop sign when it was really a yield sign, or they saw the brown jacket when it was really a green jacket. And this is an example of how when people get misinformation about some event that they themselves have experienced, it can contaminate or transform their memory.
That's so interesting. Is there a way that you can convey the misinformation that makes it more potent or more capable of contaminating? Or is it just the mere offer of the misinformation that could potentially contaminate these witnesses?
Well, in our experiments, we try to simulate what goes on in the real world. And we supply the misinformation by allowing somebody to be exposed to another witness's version, but it happened to contain wrong details. Or we ask them leading and biased questions. We also have some kind of clever ways of getting people to glom on to the misinformation. So, for example, a question like, did another car pass the red dots when it was at the intersection with the stop sign? That's actually a very clever question because the listener thinks it's about whether another car passed. And that witness is trying to recall that aspect of it. But we slip in the information that it was a stop sign. It kind of invades the mind because the witness doesn't even detect that it's coming.
So are you capable then of not just contaminating memories, but also offering false memories entirely?
Yes. After working on the misinformation effect for, I don't know, 15 or 20 years, where we would change a detail here and there in somebody's memory for an event they actually did experience, we began to wonder, well, how far can you go with people? Could you plant an entire memory into the mind of someone for something that didn't happen? And it took a few years to come up with a plan for how to study this. Eventually, what we did was we devised a way of getting people to believe and remember, and this was the first study of this rich false memory, which is what we call it now. We planted a false memory that when you were about 5 or 6 years old, you were lost in a shopping mall, that you were frightened, you were crying, and you were ultimately rescued by an elderly person and reunited with a family. And we did this by telling our research witnesses that we had talked to their mother, their father, their older relative. We found out some things that happened to them when they were a child. We presented some true experiences to them, things the mother told us really did happen. And then this completely made up scenario about the time when they were lost in the mall. And when we fed this suggestive series of scenarios to our subjects, we found about a quarter of these ordinary healthy adults fell for the suggestion and developed a partial or a complete false memory about getting lost.
Would they be able to describe back to you what the experience was?
Oh, yes. I mean, they will go way beyond the details that we use to try to plant the memory. They'll start telling us what the person looked like who rescued them. It just looked like we had succeeded in planting an entirely false memory. But I should tell you that when I first started speaking about these results, the critics, you know, some of the psychotherapists who could see where we were going with this idea got very critical. They said, getting lost is really common. You know, this doesn't mean you can plant a false memory for something that's bizarre or really upsetting. But what happened next is other investigators came along and we too planted much more bizarre and upsetting false memories. You were attacked by a vicious animal. You nearly drowned and had to be rescued by a lifeguard. You committed a crime as a teenager, and it was serious enough that the police came to investigate. All of these have now been planted in the context of experimental work in order to study the process by which people grab onto that seed of suggestion and have it grow into a really rich false memory.
Wow. I mean, that's fascinating as well. I could see potentially people saying, well, does anyone really remember what happened to them when they were five? But you remember what happened to you when you were a teenager.
Well, yeah. And you well know that many people say, I would never confess to a crime I didn't do. But that teenager study, which was a Canadian study, showed that a shocking percentage of people fell for this and began to remember that they had committed some kind of crime just a few years earlier.
Do you have to create a set of circumstances in order to plant this misinformation or these false memories?
One of the things that I think happens is that sometimes people will, with the pressure, try to think about what could have happened, what might have happened, how am I going to make sense of this? And they draw inferences. Sometimes those inferences then kind of solidify and begin to feel like a memory.
Is it simply because like an authority figure is telling them like this is what reality is, you better own up to it? Like how does that work?
In many of the studies and then the real world applications, there is an authority figure. It's a police officer doing an interrogation, getting across the idea that he knows what happened, exerting that authority. In a therapy session, it's the psychotherapist who has some authority. Let's say a woman goes into therapy, she's got anxiety or she's got depression. And the therapist says, you know, everyone I've seen with those symptoms was sexually abused as a child. I wonder if something like that happened to you. And even though the patient says, well, no, that nothing like that happened to me. Well, many people repress their memories for these experiences. So why don't you just close your eyes and imagine who might have done this to you? How old might you have been? Where might it have happened? And in response to this kind of pressured interrogation, the patient will start to imagine things. And then those things get kind of solidified and the therapist decides that it actually reflects a real experience. Well, we've done a number of studies now showing this kind of guided imagination can lead people to believe they did things they didn't do. I find it, you know, troublesome that this is the kind of thing that I have seen go on in some therapy sessions. When you've got a therapist who's got this agenda, who thinks that the cause of these symptoms are sex abuse and is determined to find it.
Mm-hmm. So basically, it's confirmation bias on the part of whoever is the authority figure. Like, they have an idea in mind of what is happening, and they impose that reality on the other person. But it's not like, you know, they're beating them with a hose. Like, they're just talking them through it. This is just a conversation between a person who is in a state of vulnerability and a person who is a figure of authority. Is it that simple? Is it that enough?
You hit a nail on the head there with the confirmation bias. That's what goes on in these cases. And that can play out in a number of ways. So they're looking for any kind of evidence that confirms their hypothesis. They're going to reject anything that disconfirms. And they can behave in all kinds of ways, like show interest when they get the details they're looking for, look bored or disappointed when it's not going their way. There's no hitting. There's no torture. Well, there can sometimes be sleep deprivation in some of these prolonged suspect interrogations. That doesn't usually happen with a witness victim. It's more common with the suspect interrogation.
People just in general seem to think like they are utterly immune from just suggestiveness, like the tone of voice. And yet it seems like in a certain scenario, when you find yourself in a isolated conversation with another human being, we are way more susceptible to suggestion than we like to think we are, is what I'm taking away from this.
Yes. And, you know, I've collected some examples of how some of the most intelligent and educated and famous and successful people that we share the planet with have fallen for a memory distortion, have come to believe something that's completely false. It sometimes gets discovered and it can be embarrassing. I'm even thinking of Hillary Clinton, who told a story about landing in Bosnia under sniper fire. She had a very specific memory of this. And ultimately, people produced videos and photos showing it was a very peaceful landing. There were children who presented her with flowers. She was there with her daughter, Chelsea. And at least she had the confidence, I said, to basically apologize and say, you know, I had a different memory. That proves I'm human.
It's always crazy because when I hear other people talk about what happened to them, I always still think, you know, some of their stories are worse.
That's Marty Tankliff, who you heard at the top of this episode.
Then when I hear like people like Saul Cassidy, who we both know quite well, say what happened to Marty is the worst example that I have ever heard. You know, it's the rare case where law enforcement gets somebody to falsely confess, but then to falsely confess against killing a family member, especially somebody as close as to your parents. You know, as Saul said, I have never seen the evilness that transpired with you.
Yeah, no, as a parent, I am utterly disgusted by what happened to you. Just wanted to say that. I'm going to kind of get emotional about it because it's just like so fucked up.
We're going to take you through the entirety of Marty's experience. A confession like his is so hard for the average layperson to understand when presented, as so many confessions are in court, without the full context, without the hours of interaction with police that occurred before the tape started rolling. So we return to the night before the crime occurred. Marty's father was hosting a high-stakes poker game at his house in Long Island. Among the players was his father's business partner, Jerry Stueman.
During the summer of 1988, their business relationship deteriorated, and my father had invested, I think, $550,000 with Jerry Stueman and started demanding it back, so much so that he had served Jerry Stueman with demand notes. And it just so happened September 6th was, you know, the night that my father hosted the poker game. And my father was this tough Brooklyn guy who, you know, nobody was going to, you know, run him out of his own home. Nobody was going to, you know, beat him out. But he let people know that he was concerned about Jerry Stueman. So holding the poker game at the house, in retrospect, seems very odd. When we now know that my father had, you know, spoken to a friend of mine's father about buying a shotgun, when he'd said to a family member, you know, Jerry Stueman threatened to cut his tongue out.
Wow.
He said to the family attorney, who's also my godfather, Jerry won't fuck with me because I know where the bones are buried. And knowing what we know now, the whole idea of knowing the bones are buried, we believe it's because Jerry's son Todd was a drug dealer. Whereas utilizing the bagel stores as kind of a money laundering front. And, you know, Jerry's not going to fuck with me because my father, I guess, realized what was happening.
Okay. Were you there as well?
I was there. I actually came home from shopping, spoke to my parents, ate dinner, went to bed because the following day was supposed to be the first day of my high school senior year.
All right. So, you know, the adults are being adults, playing poker. You're going to bed because you have school in the morning.
Yeah. And where my bedroom was compared to where the poker game was like a complete opposite end of the house. We had a ranch style house. So there were, you know, quite a distance between the two rooms. So where I was sleeping, you know, nothing could be heard from where the poker game was.
When do you wake up in the morning?
I don't remember the exact time, but it was the first day of senior year. Get up a little bit earlier, want to get ready. And I remember as soon as I woke up, I started to feel something was off because the outdoor lights were still on, which didn't seem right. And then I started walking through the house and noticed lights were on the house. The front door was open.
Were you afraid?
I don't know if I was afraid so much as something was off. It was almost like the poker game never ended. Mm. The lights were on, the door was open, and why would the door be open? And I just progressively walked through the house till I ended up where the poker game was. And that's where I discovered my father was bleeding in his office chair in the same room that the poker game took place.
Wow. And, like, could you tell what had happened to him? He was obviously unconscious.
I couldn't tell other than to notice that he was bleeding, and I immediately called 911. I tried to follow their instructions as best as possible, but I think at that state, I was just, I don't want to say discombobulated, kind of just disassociated. This wasn't real. I mean, I just turned 17. This is not supposed to be the reality, waking up to go to school. And I remember like running through the house, getting towels. Everything just kind of escalated as far as how quickly things were moving going forward. It felt like this can't be real. Like there's no way that this is really happening.
So the paramedics were giving you instructions on how to potentially help your father. Is that right? Like to resuscitate him? Is that what they were instructing you to do?
Yes. They basically said, get him flat and put a clean towel over his wounds.
Okay.
And put pressure. But, you know, me being a 17-year-old kid, I try to do it as best as possible, but I was also struggling in my head, where's my mother?
Yes, yeah.
Because, you know, I'd walk through the whole house and I didn't see my mother, and, you know, all of a sudden, your mind is racing like you want to look for your mother. Like, is she hurt? Where is she? Did she go out? Did something? Like, your brain isn't processing normally.
Yeah.
And I think at some point I almost went kind of like robotic in a sense, where I was just doing things which I thought would be normal. Like, you know, all of a sudden, tell my father, go look for my mother.
Did you find her?
Eventually I did. She was in my parents' bedroom on the floor. I didn't know it at that moment, but from what I could see, it looked like she was deceased. And it wasn't until at some point, I don't remember if it was a paramedic or an officer told me she was deceased.
Oh.
But nothing was processing. This is the worst nightmare you could ever imagine. And then it just spiraled out of control, because when the cops got there, you know, I thought I was helping them, because every question they asked, you know, I was giving them answers. Because you have to understand, too, is that my father was the police commissioner for the local village we lived in. So the idea of trusting in law enforcement was kind of ingrained. I'd never been arrested before, you know, no criminal record. So when cops showed up, it was kind of like, oh, you trust these people. They're here to help you.
So I assume that once the paramedics arrive, and they just sort of take over the attempt at some life-saving gestures, your father is alive, right?
Yes.
How did you feel in that moment? Were you still just like utterly disassociating, or like was there an ability to process the fact that like my mother is dead, my father is alive?
I don't even think I was able to process that much, because almost immediately there was the separation. You know, I was brought away from my father. I was put into the back of a police car. When a family member showed up, I wasn't allowed to be with him. The lead detective, K. James McCready, separated me even further away from everything and everybody. And I think it was at some point after McCready was there, I started to realize that something was just off, because when McCready was speaking to me, my Uncle Mike, who is my godfather, who is the family attorney, shows up. And I remember speaking to McCready and hearing this car pull up. And I was like, oh, there's my Uncle Mike now. And McCready took off running, went after him. And when McCready came back, he said something like, oh, you know, Mike said, just keep talking to us. And in the back of my head, I'm thinking, something's not right, because this is my godfather. This is somebody I've known my whole life. Why would he leave me here? You know, why would he abandon me?
So after you were put in the back of the police car, where did you go from there?
We actually went where McCready started to interview me. We were probably in front of the driveway of the next house, and I was being questioned by a number of officers there.
Okay.
When I saw the ambulance leave with my father, I kept saying, I want to go to the hospital. I want to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
And at that point, McCready says, we'll eventually take you there. But instead of taking me there, McCready took me to police headquarters, which are like 45 minutes away.
Here's Detective McCready himself in a later interview with CBS.
How soon did you really start suspecting Marty killed his parents?
Well, probably within the hour.
But that's before you've gotten any of the forensic evidence or anything.
That's correct. But the first 72 hours of any murder investigation are very critical.
But we're talking about the first hour. Why is that important to get him to the police station?
We just wanted to get him into an area where the atmosphere is more appropriate for interviewing somebody.
That is, somewhere where Marty could be further separated from his social support systems.
Was McCready talking to you while you were in the car?
Yes.
On the way there?
Yes.
What were you guys talking about?
Who do you think did this? You know, why do you think they did this? So to me, in the back of my head, I kept thinking, you know, oh, they want me to help them. They want to understand. They want to help, you know, want to help my parents. They want to help me.
Yeah.
Anyways, you know, I described my parents' relationship, you know, the problem my father was having. There were some things that I did know. I didn't know the depth of everything at that time, but I knew that my father was having problems with Stuermer.
Gosh. I mean, what's freaking tragic about all of this is it's like, from the very beginning, it's not like this was an unknown thing. Like, there was a lead, a very strong lead from the very beginning that they just did not take.
But it wasn't just me who said the same thing. You know, my brother-in-law who showed up at the house that morning where they separated, he said the same thing. He said, you guys should be looking at Stuermer. You know, when Mike Fox showed up, he said, you should be looking at Stuermer. So it wasn't just me, the kid who was at the house. It was other people who had arrived there, hadn't spoken to me, hadn't spoken to each other, who were saying the exact same thing. You know, from what we learned, every single person law enforcement spoke to that morning, that day, all said, you should be looking at Stuermer, not Marty.
When you got to the police headquarters, what was it like when you arrived there?
So when I left my house, I was only wearing shorts and like some kind of sweatshirt. I had no shoes on, no socks, no bare feet. You know, I was barefoot. So you have to realize that morning, I actually ran out of my house looking for help because it was such a disassociation that I actually really thought this was a nightmare. And I remember going into this windowless room that had a file cabinet and a desk with a big metal ring on it.
And what was their attitude towards you when you were in the police station? Was it similar, like we're just here to help, or did it get confrontational?
It exactly started the same way. It started where, you know, Marty, we're here to help you. We're here to help you. You know, just talk to us. We want to know what's going on. And, you know, one of the things that I remember at headquarters, it wasn't just McCready. There was McCready. There was Norman Ryan. And there were, you know, there were other detectives that were questioning. I mean, if somebody said how many officers, detectives spoke to you, I would have to say between 6 and 12. It just seemed it was one after another, after another, after another. And then, you know, if somebody said, how much time are you in there? I would have no idea. What I remember that day is going in the room when it was sunlight out because I walked into the building. And when I left, it was dark out.
So all day, without break, you are in that room with no ability to contact anybody, talking to police officers.
You know, the one person I knew to ask for was my Uncle Mike. He was a lawyer, he was my godfather. He was there that morning. And I remember saying, I want to speak to my Uncle Mike. Every time I said this, they said, if you want to speak to your Uncle Mike, you're a criminal and we'll just lock you up. The brain is not completely processing that because I'm thinking like, wait a minute, why am I getting locked up if I just want to speak to my Uncle Mike?
Yeah,
I haven't done anything wrong. So why am I being, you know, labeled this criminal that they're going to lock me up? And I just kept thinking like something's not right. Something's not right. But they kept saying, you know, Marty, we're just here to help you. We just want to know what happened so we can help, you know, figure this out.
How are they reacting to your description of what happened?
They would ask a question. I would give an answer. They would ask a question. I would give an answer. I don't even think I was processing exactly what was happening. Because my idea was, they're supposed to be here to help me. Let me answer the questions. They'll eventually let me go and I'll go see my family and be with my father and my other family members.
So one reason I'm asking about how they reacted to your descriptions of what happened is when I was interrogated, at first it was just open-ended questions. I noticed that the thing that was at first becoming to feel confrontational was the fact that I was asked questions over and over and over again. However, they remained like open-ended questions in the sense of like, what did you do first? And then what did you do next? And so it wasn't like a, well,
It wasn't confrontational necessarily. It wasn't them saying, no, that's wrong. It was them just asking me to repeat over and over and over again the same information to different police officers over the course of a number of days. But then there was this shift that happened in my final interrogation where I was accused of lying. So I walked into a, you know, that room with them and they were like, we think you're lying. And they confronted me with a small lie first. The small lie that I did lie about was whether or not anyone in my house smoked marijuana. They were like, we know you smoked marijuana. You lied to us. What else are you lying to us about? So already I was like, I was in a confrontational scenario, but like, I felt sort of caught out and in trouble and guilty for having lied about marijuana because I didn't want to get my roommates in trouble for smoking marijuana. So I was like put on my toes like this and suddenly having to defend myself and thinking, oh, this is why they're now asking me to repeat over again all of the same information that I've been saying over the past several days. And when I repeated my, you know, I went home, I took a shower, whatever, like I ate lunch and then I went with Raffaele over to my apartment. They started like nitpicking all of the things that I said and started acting like what I was saying didn't make any sense. And that was how they sort of like slowly chipped away at my confidence, even in my own memories. And I'm wondering if there was something similar happening with you where there was an attempt to chip away at either the legitimacy of your responses or at your own sanity, at whether or not your own memories could be trusted.
It was both. There was a point where instead of questioning, it became confrontational or accusatory, where they said, Marty, we know you did it. You know, just tell us you did it. And, you know, I was denying it. And then after the constant denials, at some point, McCready did what we've commonly called the fake phone call. He left the room and he did something like, yeah, that's great. You know, thank you. And he came back into the interrogation room and said, Marty, you know, they just pumped your father full of adrenaline. He's awake and he's identified as you, as the person who attacked him.
So this is the part where I get really fucking emotional, because this, for me, this lie that your own father identified you as the perpetrator is so obviously fucked up to me that, like, I'm a little shocked. I, like, cannot deal with this as a parent. How could you tell a child that their own parent accused them of attacking them and murdering them? Like, what goes through your mind when you hear McCready tell you that?
Well, they magnified it, because then to top that off, they said, Marty, we know you did it because we have your hair in your mother's hands. And they said, we also know you lied to us because you said you took a shower the night before and we did a humidity test. And we know you'll, but like in my brain, you know, I'm thinking, wait a minute, I know I didn't do anything, but my father said that I did it. And they're saying my hair's in my mother's hands and I never took a shower, but they're, you know, I didn't know what the hell, and I know that a humidity test wasn't a real thing. I mean, I was a kid back then. I'm a kid. And you start to doubt yourself. You know, all of a sudden I kept saying, I never didn't do anything. And then I said, you know, I'll take a polygraph test. Marty, your father said you did it. Just tell us you did it. And you, in the back of your head, you start to play tricks with yourself. You know, you start to doubt reality and you start to believe what they're telling you because they're confident. You know, the one thing I've learned is that their confidence makes you start to believe them. You know, and everything I've been through in life now and knowing what I know now, they're trained to make their confidence make it believable. You know, they're trained to sell a good story. as a kid, you just don't understand that. You know, you're the only thing that's processing in your head is like, your father said you did this. From that point forward, everything was different. The tone was different. The voices were different. The confrontations were different. The questions were different. The whole attitude that happened from that point forward was different.
Yeah. Can you describe those differences? Like, if you had to say the attitude was this at first and then it became that, what would it be?
One of the easiest ways to describe it was that it was a conversation to transform to an intense interview, to transform into screaming matches at times, to physicality being used at times.
Like what?
I was choked at one point. I was thrown up against a wall, you know, to the good cop, bad cop. I remember at one point, you know, Detective Ryan was sitting next to me and he's had his hands on my knees. I'm like, Marty, just tell us what happened. It's okay. And then you'd have MacCready saying, be a fucking man and just telling she did this. So they learned how to play the mind tricks and everything was just so confusing. And I remember from that point forward, it didn't matter what I said that was truthful. All they wanted to know or hear was what they wanted. You know, if I said the sky was blue and they kept saying, no, it's not blue, it's pink. Mm. You know, but I'm like, no, it's blue outside. If I didn't say pink, we weren't going forward anywhere. We were stuck on the sky.
Yeah.
And the entire interrogation going forward was like that. You know, basically got to the point where I had to accept and regurgitate every single thing that they said. Didn't matter what it was.
What were they wanting you to regurgitate? What specifically?
That I had bludgeoned my parents with a dumbbell in my room, that I'd used a knife that was next to a watermelon in the kitchen, which was next to where the poker game was, that I did it for specific reasons, that, you know, we had all these fights. My parents and I had these fights, which weren't true. You know, I remember at one point them just saying, Marty, just tell us what we want to hear and you'll go home. You'll leave this room. And I kept going back and forth in my head every time something like that happened was when I would say, I didn't do anything. Marty, we don't want to hear that. We know you did it. Your father said you did it. Just tell us you did it.
Oh, my God.
So you start playing this mind game with yourself. The sense of reality is gone. I mean, basically, the floor you're standing on has just fallen through. And nothing that you think is reality. Because what you know to be true, you're being told isn't true. You're being basically told, that's not true. We know what's fact. Your father told you did this. And we know everything in between.
Right. Yeah, the trump card being your father, what supposedly what your father said.
Yes.
And it's just like, how do you fight that? How do you contest that? I mean, I know that like they didn't say that to me. What they told me was that my memories didn't make any sense when I was trying to describe what I was doing that night. They were like, that doesn't make any sense. That's not what the evidence is showing. We know you were physically there when the crime occurred. What were you doing? You know, we know that you made an appointment with your boss, that he was with you. What did he do? Like, it was incredibly suggestive. And when I kept saying to them, I have no memory of what you say is real, then they said, well, maybe you don't have any memories because it was so horrible that you blacked it out.
They do that for me too. They use the whole blackout thing. At some point, MacCready said, well, maybe you blacked out, but you know what? Your father said you did it. And you know, this resting on your father said you did it is kind of what always resonated throughout this whole thing. You know, we know you did it. Your father said you did it. Your hair in your mother's hands. And it didn't matter if I fought it. It didn't matter every time I told the truth. It got to the point where they were stuck in their ways and I wasn't leaving that room till they got what they wanted to get.
I remember that moment for me and like psychologically what it felt like, because like it was almost a relief to be given an idea that would make sense of this like overwhelming pressure cooker of a situation. Like you're under so much pressure and everyone's yelling at you and upset with you and they're telling you you did something wrong and you don't even know what it is and you just want to like, you just want them to stop yelling at you. Or in my case, they'd like hit me on the back of the head and I was just like, please, just like, I just wanted it all to stop. And then as soon as they say, well, maybe you blacked out, instead of like running away from that, which is what people think a person would do in that situation, be like, fuck you, I know what's true. Instead, you're like, oh my God, maybe this is the answer to everything. Maybe this explains why they're so mad at me. Maybe this makes sense, even though if you were outside of that pressure cookover situation, you would never think that that would make sense. Within that pressure cookover situation, it was almost a relief for me, the idea that like, oh, I just witnessed something bad. And that's why they're all upset at me. That's why I don't have any answers, even though they say I have the answers. I just blacked it out.
This suggestion of a blackout is actually quite common in internalized false confession cases. When Wes Myers was accused of killing his girlfriend in South Carolina in 2001, he was put through an interrogation similar to Marty's. And after suggesting that he blacked out, Myers finally relented and said, I must have done it.
They mind raped me and made me believe I killed someone I love.
In New York City in 2014, Malthy Thompson was accused of molesting children. A false evidence ploy was used on him, as it was on Marty. Thompson was told they had video footage of him committing the crime, and he began to doubt his own memory. I couldn't remember having done it, he said, but if it's on video, then it would have to be true. Then there's Daniel Anderson, who was accused of murdering his friend in Chicago in 1980. He, too, was presented with false evidence, a photo police had arranged with the murder weapon next to a pair of gloves he owned. The detective insisted that people can commit horrific acts without remembering them, which led Anderson to confess. In all these cases, once the interrogators have convinced a suspect that their memory is flawed, they can begin to suggest a false memory.
And then they're like, well, but now you have to remember what you blacked out. And so I was suddenly under all this pressure to remember things that I could not remember. And like, it was only through a course of like suggestions, like, okay, well, you say you met with your boss. Where did you meet with him? What did you see? Almost like a guided meditation into a murder scene where I'm like, I guess I must have heard her scream. I'm like trying to piece together a coherent narrative based upon the idea that I don't remember the truth. But if I don't remember the truth, I'm going to go to prison.
For me, it was, they would say, Marty, just say, you know, just say X, Y, and Z. You know, just say, Marty, yes, you use the knife. Just say, yes, you use the dumbbell, and we'll stop. And every single question was, you know, I'd fight with them, and finally I would just give in and say, okay, whatever you say, fine, sure, whatever, let's just move on. But for me, the realization was in the back of my head, I knew that none of it was true. And when that became reality was the minute, literally the minute I was away from them, I remember getting a phone call with my half-sister, and I remember her asking, did you say you did it? And I remember saying to her, yes, but they made me.
That false confession sent Marty to prison for almost 18 years, longer than he had been alive at the time.
Accused of Marty Tankle, accused of killing his parents. These kinds of interrogations often include the suspect becoming confused by the lie, but how's that possible? How could my DNA be on the scene when I wasn't there? And then the detective might sometimes say something like, well, you know, people black out bad memories. You may have repressed it. That happens. Or you may have been sleepwalking. That happens. Or in one case in Illinois, you had a lot of beer that night. You probably had an alcoholic blackout. And so what they do is they provide this theory that bridges the gap between their lie and the fact that the suspect doesn't have a memory. And we're telling you why you don't have a memory. And this is where the confusion sits in. It's no wonder that people sometimes break down in a state of confusion and confess not because their will has been broken, but because they're just cognitively now mesmerized, confused. They don't know what to think anymore.
This has actually been shown in a laboratory setting. Saul Kassin designed an experiment along with Catherine Lee Mitchell to test whether false evidence could lead people to confess in an act of compliance. They recruited 79 pairs of college students to take part in a test that was supposedly about timing keyboard strokes of certain letters to a metronome. This was a ruse.
Before the test began, the experimenter informed the students that there was a glitch in the program and to be careful not to hit the Alt key or the program would crash and all the data would be lost. 60 seconds in, the experimenter would interrupt the subject, tinker with the computer to confirm that the program had crashed, then accuse the subject of hitting the Alt key.
No one had actually hit the Alt key, and all subjects denied doing so at first. But when a Confederate posing as the second subject delivered false eyewitness testimony, claiming that they saw the student hit the Alt key, that changed. The experimenter then presented them a handwritten confession note that read, "I hit the Alt key and caused the program to crash. Data were lost. My fault."
Not only were students who were subjected to the false evidence ploy twice as likely to sign the confession, but many even internalized their own guilt. When they exited the test room and went back to the waiting room, another Confederate, posing as a student waiting to take the test, would ask them what the commotion was about, and a sizable number of subjects admitted guilt to this stranger.
Even more striking, when experimenters asked the subjects to go over their keystrokes one by one to find the moment they hit the Alt key, a subset of those who'd internalized their guilt also confabulated stories about how they'd hit the Alt key that they never actually hit. Saying things like, "Yes, stop right here. I hit it with the side of my right hand after you called out the A."
This was the first experiment to produce false confessions in a lab. The results were stunning. 69% of students signed the confession. 28% internalized their guilt, and 9% confabulated explanations for their actions. Now, this is a low-stakes scenario, but the pressure and authority the subjects were confronted with was also mild. In a homicide interrogation, the stakes and potential consequences are high: life in prison or the death penalty. And as we've seen with Marty, the false evidence employed can be psychologically devastating.
You know, in the case of the patients, well, I constantly get people saying, why would anyone want to believe their father molested them in satanic rituals if it wasn't true? And I say, well, if there's a cost to it, there must be a really big benefit. Let's look for the benefit. And the benefit there for the patient is, they're in therapy because they've got problems. They've, you know, misbehaving. Their life isn't going right. They're anxious, depressed, whatever. What's the explanation? A, B, or C? C is you're crazy. Nobody wants that. B is you're a bad person. No one wants that. A, you were abused. It's almost a more palatable explanation for the patient, a more comfortable one. And that might tell us something about the motivation.
And as for the motivation of the interviewer or the psychologist, is it simply that, like, they have a sort of pet theory that happens to be their preference, and so they just automatically go to, oh, satanic ritual, or, oh, you're bipolar? Is it simple as that?
Well, I think in the case of the therapist, they just don't have other ideas about what could be causing the symptoms. They've got their theory that it's buried childhood trauma, and their job is to dig it out. They don't consider there could be sort of a genetic or a family dysfunction or some other explanation. You know, as for the police, they develop a hypothesis, and they've got an interest in closing the case. And they get an award when the case is solved and over, and not when it's dangling and unsolved.
In July 2008, a state Supreme Court justice dismissed all charges against Marty Tankleff in the murder of his parents, Arlene and Seymour Tankleff. But even then, Detective MacReady remained convinced that Marty Tankleff was guilty.
If Arlene fought off her attacker, as you said,
right,
how do you explain that Marty had no injuries?
Doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to have injuries.
Was there any of his tissue under her nails?
I don't recall right now.
In fact, there was no evidence of Marty on her body, was there?
I don't recall.
No, there's no hair, no tissue, nothing from Marty on her body. Nor on Seymour's. Why would he call 911 when his dad was still alive?
I don't think he knew his father was still alive.
He could hear him gasping. He said that. Do you think you've ever had a false confession?
No.
Never?
No.
How do you know?
No. Because I think if I'd had one, I'd know about it by now, wouldn't I?
And you're sure this one isn't?
I'm positive that one isn't.
Are you proud of the work you did in this case?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Would you have done anything differently?
No, I don't think so. Given the same set of circumstances, I don't see anything that I would have done differently.
How does law enforcement respond to your work?
Well, it depends. I mean, you know, sometimes I get invited to lecture to the Secret Service or the FBI or to do something for the CIA. But there's still others out there who I think believe in this idea of repressed memory. And if somebody comes along and says, I just remembered this and I want to prosecute the person, they will go ahead and do it.
How about just the lay person? Are people aware of your work and its implications?
It depends on who you ask. I mean, a few years ago, with grad students and colleagues, we published a paper called Are the Memory Wars Over? Are people out there still believing, after all this criticism, that massive repression is possible and common or whatever? And we found that in some circles, it's still embraced. And yet in other circles, it's rejected. So it's very controversial still.
Lay people, of course, are who make up juries. And aside from potentially believing in the idea of repressed memories, they tend to trust confessions for the same reasons we all do.
Jurors believe that, you know, people wouldn't confess to something they didn't do. Who would act in that lack of self-interest? They don't think that they would be able to be contaminated to the point where they would remember some complete thing that didn't happen. And they're the ones who are making the decisions in court cases. So that's why we think it's helpful to educate these jurors.
Right.
In some way, through expert testimony, through jury instructions, so they learn some things about human memory that can help them make better decisions. And not just uncritically accept the claim without giving it any scrutiny. And I'd be sort of curious where you'd put yourself in that category. There are at least three kinds of false confessions. There are the people who might have some mental instability, or they just want to be connected to a famous case, and so they confess to kidnapping the Lindbergh baby or JonBenet Ramsey. There are people who just confess because they don't really believe they did the thing, but they see it as the only way out of an awful situation. And then there's this smaller category of people who actually come to believe they did it.
I was definitely internalized. So I got to the point where what really like triggered the sort of crisis of my own consciousness in this moment was, first of all, when they told me that the person who I had spent the whole night when the murder happened, they told me that he said, no, that's not true. It never occurred to me, one, that the police would lie to me, and two, that he would say that I wasn't with him if that wasn't true. And I was really confused by that. But then on top of that, mounting pressure of, we have proof that you were at home the night that the crime happened. So again, more lies coming at me. Then the real kicker for me was when they said, maybe you witnessed something that it was so horrible that you don't even remember it. And that was the thing that was like really started to like crack my mind, because I had no memory of my friend being murdered. I had no memory of being at my house that night. And they said, well, maybe you don't have a memory of this, not because you didn't witness it and you weren't there, but because it was so horrible that you can't remember it. And they were very suggestive, you know, like, here's this phone, like, you had a text message with this guy named Patrick. Did you meet with Patrick? What did Patrick do? I was internalizing a lot of what was being suggested to me. And it was only once they stopped yelling at me and stopped smacking me in the back of the head and they left me alone and all of that pressure went away that I went, wait a second, what just happened? Like, I'm now some like witness in a trial and I have like zero actual memory of what they're telling me I remember. And it was really, really scary. That was my experience.
Well, that is truly fascinating. And I have seen something similar happen in other cases. I mean, it's bringing to mind the case of Paul Ingram, who worked for the sheriff's department as a civilian in Olympia, Washington, and got all caught up in accusations of satanic ritual abuse of his daughter. And when he was first accused of this, I mean, he basically said, I raised my children not to lie. And maybe I blanked it out somehow. And so there was that kind of effort to try to explain his lack of memory in exactly the same way.
So as a psychologist, like, what is happening with an internalized false memory, be it a confession or some kind of incriminating admission or a false memory of a witness? Like, what is happening psychologically?
Well, I think that people, you know, can, you know, start to imagine what is being suggested, and they can, you know, create something akin to a visualization of it. And they get fed all this information that it's really real, and they start to believe it's real. And one of the things that we do know is that false memories, once they're implanted, can be felt with a lot of confidence, can be described in a lot of detail. You can have emotion and cry while you tell the story, even though the whole event never happened. So you can't use these usual cues that we sometimes use to decide that a memory is real when we're hearing it from someone else. We can't use detail or confidence or emotion because false memories can have those same characteristics. You really need independent corroboration to know whether you're dealing with an authentic memory or one that's a product of some other process.
We've looked at everything from the third degree to false evidence ploys and suggestions of memory loss that coerce innocent people into confessing. But what comes after that? And what can we do to stop this from happening? Stay tuned for the next and final episode of False Confessions, Scars and Solutions.
In the meantime, get lost with us. Find us on Blue Sky at amandanox.com.
At wisecracker.bsky.social.
On Instagram, at Amamanox.
At MC Carbon.
You can learn more about our work and how to support it at amandanox.com. And look, I know you don't remember promising to leave us a 5-star review, but you probably just blacked it out. Do us a solid.
False Confessions, a Labyrinth miniseries, is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. This episode was written and produced by us, along with our managing producer, Andre Sepp, and our production assistant, Charlie Darnell. Our theme music is by Josh Budo Karp.